On ABC Radio National, Amanda Smith with you, and an artworks feature that's all about Merlin. Merlin the Magician, but not just the famous one of the Arthurian legends. Actually, Merlin has been represented in all sorts of different ways in art and literature throughout the ages. He wasn't, for example, always an old man with a pointy hat and a wispy beard. Early on, he wasn't even very magical. The Many Faces of Merlin is the subject of a new book by Stephen Knight. He's Distinguished Research Professor in English Literature at Cardiff University. And as Stephen Knight tells Lynn Gallagher, what Merlin does always personify is knowledge. And a study of him shows how the status of knowledge shifts over time in relation to power. Now, the Welsh refer to Merlin as Merfyn, and Stephen Knight begins his survey of Merlin in art and literature by introducing and reading from an old Welsh poem.
This is one of the Murddin poems, written down, we think, around the year 1100, and in this, Murddin of Cumbria is in exile and speaking about his wretched position and how he's been cut off from Celtic British heroic society after the Battle of Arvderydd, where something terrible happened. Probably his fault. Sweet apple tree that grows in a clearing, its virtue hides it from the lords of Rhyddech. Now Gwynedd loves me not, and she welcomes me not. I am hateful to Gwasawg, Rhyddech's supporter. I have destroyed her son and her daughter. Death has taken everyone. Why does it not greet me? And after Gwenddola, no lords revere me. No amusement gladdens me. No lover visits me. In the battle of Arvderydd, my torque was of gold. I am not now a treasure to a swan-like maiden.
Stephen Knight, thanks for joining us on Artworks today.
My pleasure.
That poem, it's kind of grim.
Grim, yes. This is Murddin in exile, regretting everything, sort of except his integrity, as it were.
And that is the kind of Merlin that you're drawn to and that your book is trying to compare the old Merlin with the new Merlin.
Yes. Well, I'm so drawn to all the Merlins and the Merlins, really. As I see them, he is a mythic figure representing knowledge of various forms in various periods, but always knowledge.
And the new Merlin, let's hear a poem from the new, because things happen to knowledge, and this is the interesting thing about your thesis, that knowledge shifts in some way and society's relationship to knowledge shifts.
Exactly. Well, this is a poem, I think it's a very fine poem, by Edwin Muir, slightly forgotten poet, I think, unjustly. This comes from his Journeys and Places collection, 1937. Muir was born in Orkney. And he left Orkney for Glasgow when he was 14. And he always said that he was 200 years old. He'd been born before the Industrial Revolution and had lived into the 20th century. And what he felt troubled by modernity in all its forms, except modern poetry, of course. And in this, he's using Merlin as a sort of image of an Edenic ideal world, and he talks about putting the apple back on the tree. And so he's seeing Merlin here as sort of an ideal state of pure pre-fall knowledge. O Merlin, in your crystal cave, deep in the diamond of the day, will there ever be a singer whose music will smooth away the furrow drawn by Adam's finger across the meadow and the wave? Or a runner who'll outrun man's long shadow driving on, break through the gate of memory and hang the apple on the tree? Will your magic ever show the sleeping bride shut in her bower, the day wreathed in its mound of snow and time locked in his tower?
Time locked in his tower. What does that refer to?
Well, he was against time. He thought time had damaged him and damaged the world and made modernity. And it was a sort of poet dreaming of a sort of pre-time image. You know, it's almost an indigenous idea. So that there is a time beyond time, or a sort of idea of a deity outside of time. And he's using Merlin as this sort of ultimate root of omniscient knowledge.
It is lovely to hear the different Merlins in different pieces of literature, but you've really actually in your book tracked Merlin through images as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how Merlin shifts, you know, in some of the early images and then to the pointy hat and the beard and the more magical figure?
Yes, there are a lot of Merlin images. I think this is basically because Merlin got very early attached to the King Arthur myth. And so it was a myth that was presented in literature for kings and great lords and great ladies. And so they had very beautiful books which were illustrated. And, you know, that went on into the 19th century when the Pre-Raphaelites did some fantastic Merlins. Yes, they really do change. Early on, Merlin isn't as we know him. He's not old. He's not bearded. He's not even very magical. He's a man of knowledge. There's a wonderful 12th and 13th century, quite common illumination of Merlin building Stonehenge. And he's a red-headed giant mason who's lifting the stones into place with an assistant just guiding him. And the early stories tell that, you know, he did it somehow with his engines. It wasn't magic at all. He was just
a clever.
He knew a lot and is a source of immense wisdom. And the medieval Merlin sort of represents almost an allegory of knowledge, knowing how to do things. For example, the medieval Merlin, unfortunately we don't have a picture of this, disguises King Uther as Lord Gorlois so he can, you know, go with Igraine. It's not magic at all. You don't know what he's done, but it's something like makeup and disguise. That medieval Merlin, whom I call a sort of the figure of wisdom because he has deep knowledge, is transmuted over time in many ways. And as you say, one of the most interesting ones is the modern Merlin, the old Merlin, who is bearded. This is a 19th century idea. And I think the old Merlin is a way of containing knowledge. He's like a sort of the schoolmaster or schoolmistress you learnt a lot from, but they're not you, not young and thrusting like you, like me, you know. It's the modern idea of the individual being defined against this older person. And as I like to say, you know, the pointy hat means he might be pointy-headed as well, you know. All that education is very good and we're going to profit from it, but we don't really value it that much. We value our youthfulness, our consumer capacities and so on.
And that even gets started in the 19th century versions of the King Arthur myth. I don't know much about the original versions of the King Arthur myth, but you've got this idea that he is there as an assistant to power.
Yeah. He becomes in the 19th century, slowly, and really only in the 20th century with T.H. Wright, he becomes an educator. That's my fourth of the four great Merlins, wisdom, cleverness, and then education at the end. And so, yes, he helps power. He's always helped power, and power is always a little uneasy about this help because they can't really do without him. But the making him a sort of foolish old schoolmaster type is a way, I think, of containing him.
When did that first start? Because really, if you had Merlin as a historical figure, as opposed to the mythological one, and he is obviously both, he couldn't have existed when King Arthur existed.
No. It's an odd thing about Merlin, as the Welsh call him. There is some case to be made for a real Merlin or Merlin, a better case than a real King Arthur, because when we first hear of him, he is a prince of Cumbria, modern Cumberland, which is Celtic, British. This is before the Anglo-Saxons have arrived with their version of culture. And he has been fighting in a royal battle, and he has become an exile. Something traumatic has happened in the battle. He may have killed one of his own relatives. We're not quite sure. He doesn't say. It's his poetry, not narrative. And he becomes a sort of a dropout from heroic society, a critique. You get this in early Anglo-Saxon poetry too, the exile, who understands the limitations of heroic society. You know, and that is the early Merlin, whose name becomes Merlin in Latin and French. And he represents a sort of a natural wisdom, sitting under an apple tree, speaking to a little pig. It's his friend or familiar, you might almost say. There are figures like this in Ireland, of course, Sweeney Agonisti, Sweeney the Wild, same figure. But Merlin sort of predates him. And actually, if there was the heroic figure of Merlin, he's not quite the same date as Arthur. They've come together later on.
Then when does he assume magical powers?
The medievals on Merlin, if you read the 13th century prose French stories, he can always do a bit of magic. You know, I don't think they regard magic very highly. It's a sort of low level of... he can raise a mist to confuse the enemy. He can, of course, change his shape. He can appear as a peasant. He can appear as a little boy. Never appears as a lord, mind you. He's always sort of, there's always some social resistance in his appearance. But they don't make magic the be-all and end-all. It is, I think, 19th century, 20th century, when we are no longer so deeply supernatural in our religion, that magic becomes big. And I think the magic, making it a knowledge of magic, is also a form of containment.
Why? Just say a bit more about
that. Well, it's
that.
Tricks.
Okay, so...
So the T.H. White famously makes Merlin do these funny tricks with a sort of mustard pot that strolls across the table. It's the Disneyfication, if you like, of knowledge.
And it trivialises knowledge.
Exactly.
The night was dark, and storm clouds marched along the sky. Rain beat against the grey castle walls. Inside, in a bedroom hung with tapestries, the young King Arthur tossed in his sleep. In a dream, he saw an ordinary young boy, dressed in common clothes, pulling a sword from a stone. Around him, knights and lords laughed loudly, the sounds sharper than a wound, for the sword was heavy and the boy had to struggle to hold it aloft. It grew heavier and heavier in the dream until at last it dropped to the ground with a loud crash that drowned out the laughter.
This is the beginning of one version of the King Arthur legend, which famously has the young king pulling a sword called Excalibur out of a stone. It's an interesting part of the Merlin story because in some versions, Merlin represents Christianity as he guides the young king towards his destiny. Meaning Excalibur, is the first time that Merlin can be seen on the side of the church.
Originally, he doesn't do that. Originally, he knows what's going to happen, but it's the bishop, it's God's representative, who fixes the sword in the stone. Merlin can understand it all, and he can tell Arthur what to do, but he's much more like a grand vizier and advisor. It's actually quite late, and mostly in the later 19th century, that Merlin does all the trickery. It's the magical Merlin who does all that. The sword in the stone is a sort of curious story that comes out of nowhere and validates Arthur, and once it gets into the myth, it stays there. And Merlin is not very closely associated with it.
Is there an element of him, his magic being less than the magic of the Christian church?
Oh, I think so. In fact, there's a sort of quite difficult relationship between Merlin and the Christian church. In the 1130s, Geoffrey of Monmouth writes a history of the kings of Britain, the first really big discussion of both Arthur and Merlin. This is where they first sort of come together. And he says he has a nasty character, say perhaps that Merlin is the son of the devil. Many, many scholars and critics have read this and said Geoffrey is saying Merlin's the son of the devil. He doesn't say that. It's a nasty man called Maugantius, which is from Mal Gani, the Welsh for bad speaking. Later on, this idea is taken up, and in a wonderful French poem, about 1200, almost forgotten, by Robert de Boron, he actually tells us that Merlin was created by the devils as their own answer to Christ. He was going to represent them on earth. And what happened was his mother was a saintly woman, and she saved him. Her father's a devil. They like illustrating this in the Middle Ages. They like illustrating the moment of conception where there's a serious-looking devil, you know, it's sort of Merlin soft porn, as it were. But the mother saves him for Christ, and he becomes the prophet of the Grail. But that vanishes. The whole story of a half-devil dealing with the Grail, you can't cop that, and you have to sort of bring it back into full Christianity. So the idea of the man of secular knowledge and wisdom and the church wisdom, there's always a little bit of frisson and tension between Merlin and the church.
And that would fit neatly into your speaking truth to power thesis.
Mm. Well,
because yes, the church is the power institution in those
days.
Yes,
that's right. And very good French scholars have been arguing that the 13th century French establishment of the big Arthur and Merlin stories is in fact the beginning of secular literature. These people who write it are clerks, but their job is really history chronicle, not Christian material. And it may well be that the Arthur Merlin stories are the beginning of sort of secular knowledge. And, yeah, wherever power is, there's always some uneasiness about knowledge and Merlin. Speaking as a professor at a university today.
Stephen Knight is a professor of English at Cardiff University and has just released a book on Merlin. This is Artworks on ABC Radio National, and I'm Lynn Gallagher.
The transformation of base metals into gold, negative into positive. The ultimate power over the natural world. And the quest for that secret has begun. "'Twas writ with golden quill that Merlin's astrolabe will betray the sign you seek. Illuminations from the ancient..."
Tell me a little bit more about the transformations and the art. You've got some lovely images about Merlin being different kinds of figures, and they are very mysterious images.
Yeah. Yes, they are. There's one I really love, and there are quite a lot of versions of this, which is we're at court and there's Arthur and all his mob. They're all looking alike and making the same gesture. They're listening. And what they're listening to is a small, ragged boy who is Merlin, and he's carrying a club. Now, in my view, the person who drew that didn't need me to write a book. He knew exactly about knowledge and power. And so Merlin is always a figure of apparently no social value, who has some sort of mysterious impact. He's a peasant who knows where the knight should go. And the most magical one of all to me is the one where it's a crazy story, and I think this is all Merlin's spin-off story, in which Merlin goes to Rome and sorts out some problems in the emperor's household caused by the emperor's wife, you know, who is causing quite a bit of trouble. In fact, he resolves a dream that the emperor's had, which is about his wife. But he arrives in the form of a stag. And there's a wonderful painting in magnificent colour that was put into a printed book with manuscript illustrations for the King of France in about 1500. And it shows this wonderful, you know, rich beige stag arriving in the green forest. And so he's a stag. He's the noblest of beasts. Merlin has this natural, almost environmental clout going behind him. And the transformations show that he is nature, not culture.
That's actually even extending your argument further, isn't it? Nature, not culture, embodying animals, to say the knowledge of how we should be and how we should live in this planet in animals is a very interesting, almost getting back perhaps to paganism and nature worship, or is it something else?
I think you're right there. I mean, one of the very early stories, which is a terrific story, is that Merlin has left court, and he said to his wife, "I'm going now, and you can get married again, and let me know, I'll come to the wedding." And so she does, and he arrives riding a stag and leading a line of animals from the forest. And he's in sort of pretty good mood, Merlin, but unfortunately the next husband looks out of the window at him, so he tears the stag's antlers off and throws them through his body and kills him. That's power. That's the sort of power of knowledge, isn't it? And what I found fascinating is that T.H. White, whom I admire greatly, has represented a Merlin who educates the young Arthur naturally. He turns him into a fish, a badger, a hawk, so he learns the wisdom of the world to see if this can help a king in the 20th century control what he calls might. And, you know, he's writing in the 1930s. And I think that there are quite a lot of artists and writers who saw ahead that if there is a sort of a deep-seated knowledge, it's a natural knowledge, and they understood that as we would now call it environmental wisdom.
It's really interesting to hear you tell those stories, because my modern brain keeps trying to find a literal moral. I guess that's something that we've kind of... In the 20th century, we evolved this idea that the meaning of a story was to find a moral. But some of those, even though there's this idea of natural wisdom, the obvious moral isn't there.
Yes, what these stories do, and myths are often like this, they just tell you it's a struggle. You know, the modern moral would be it's dialectical. You know, these are conflicts that we are still in. And whether in the ABC or in a university, you feel that, you know, there are administrators and managers are giving you a hard time. This is all we talk about in Britain these days. That is the same dialectic of knowledge and power. And if you think back, you can see the formations and then recognize them in your own time.
So do you think our understanding of what power is has changed?
I think the nature of power, the dialectic is still going on, but I think the nature of power has certainly changed. For example, I argue that what the 20th century artists, Merlin artists, are using, power is actually the individual. And this is what White says. Eventually, King Arthur is a noble person. You know, as king, he's useless, but gee, he's a good bloke. You know, so he becomes the hero of a musical comedy, and very well too. And so the recent Merlin on television... with a young Merlin. Now, you could say, well, isn't that good? They must have been reading Geoffrey of Monmouth when Merlin is young. But, aha, I'm afraid this is not true. I know some of the people involved in this, and what they say is it's a young Merlin because, Steve, as my friend said to me, makeup and trainers. The young Merlin goes right into the 10 to 12-year-old age group, who apparently the boys wear a lot of trainers because their feet are growing, and 12-year-old girls use more makeup than any other women because they have to wash it off at school and put it on again to go home. And so they're doing very well advertising makeup and trainers, and the power is the individual consumer.
So if Merlin were a real figure and reacting to that kind of telemarketing, what would
I don't know. Perhaps the television company would be struck by lightning. Who's to say? We can think about that ourselves.
Is there also a link in the changing of these stories and how we understand them between the conscious and the unconscious mind?
I'm not sure I'd go as far to say that, though, in fact, Jung does talk a lot about Merlin, the wise old man figure. And Jungians, it's actually Emma Jung, his wife more than Jung himself, does a lot with this. There's a very interesting book on the Grail by Emma Jung and Marie-Louise von Franz, which has got a whole chapter on Merlin that tells us a lot. What I would say is, if you look at the structures of the myth over time, you have to sort of find reasons. For example, the English romantics, British romantics, if you like, including Scott and some Welsh writers, didn't like Merlin. When they use him, he's a horrible old perv, basically, and stupid. Why not? They still associated him with science knowledge and rationalism. They associated him with a sort of a clarity of thought, an orderly thought that they were rejecting. If they liked the medieval, they liked a sort of more easy peasant, romantic medieval. And if you look at the structure of myth, you'll find things you don't understand, and you've got to dig into them, and perhaps they are more unconscious than conscious, those structures.
All right, so finishing on a note of the war, do you want to just leave us with one final Merlin poem?
Okay. This is another unfairly forgotten poet, Edwin Arlington Robinson, American poet, turn of the century and into the 20s. He mostly wrote fairly short, almost pastorals or Georgian-American poems, but he wrote three big Arthurian poems, and this I think is the best, called Merlin. And he wrote it in 1916-17, and he was aware of the time. An age was passing, American troops were going to France, and he felt strongly about this. And Merlin in this is not a magician. He's a very wise man who understands things. And he actually wants to be off in Broceleon with Vivian because they are lovers and she loves him and understands him. But he feels it's his duty to come back at the end and see what's happened. And it's all happened. It's all collapsed. And the final scene is him and Dagonet, who is a knight, but is a foolish knight, who's used in Tennyson. And he's almost a Charlie Chaplin figure, Dagonet, at the end. And it's just the two of them walking away. And this is the end of this rather grim, a poem, you know, Merlin in 1917, this poem is. They arose, and saying nothing, found a groping way down through the gloom together. Fiercer now, the wind was like a flying animal that beat the two of them incessantly with icy winds and bit them as they went. The rock above them was an empty place where neither seer nor fool should view again the stricken city. Colder blew the wind across the world, and on it heavier lay the shadow and the burden of the night, and there was darkness over Camelot.
And in the darkness we shall leave you.
That's right.
Thank you very much, Stephen Knight.
Okay, thank you, Lynn.
Stephen Knight speculating on who our contemporary Merlins might be, who today can speak truth to power. UN weapons inspectors, maybe. And Stephen Knight was speaking with Lynn Gallagher. His book is called Merlin, Knowledge and Power Through the Ages, and it's published by Cornell University Press. Details are on the Artworks website. I'm Amanda Smith, and this is Radio National, abc.net.au/rn.